This is Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm John DeLynn. On this episode of Mormon Stories, I interview Tyler Meesom and Jenny Lynn Merton, independent filmmakers and co-directors of the documentary film Sons of Perdition. Their film follows the Lost Boys, a group of young, poorly educated outcasts from the closed communities of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a polygamous sect led by the infamous Warren Jeffs.
These are three boys who were kicked out of Colorado City. They have very little education, very little knowledge of the outside world, and they're told they're going to hell. And then they're thrust out into this world they know nothing about. And at first, it's very titillating. It's just very much girls and parties and beer and pop music and rap music and MTV, and they just inundate. They throw themselves in to a point where it's dangerous, to where they really suffer. And then they realize, this isn't something I want to do.
They discuss the challenges of obtaining the trust of their subjects, developing a familial bond while maintaining the necessary critical distance, efforts to help family members and victims escape, confrontations with parents, and the general challenges of making the film.
Making this film was emotionally, spiritually, financially trying in every single way. It beat us down. It hurt. It was hard. It was exhausting. And I wouldn't trade any of it.
They also discuss the difficulty of leaving polygamous communities, the loss of family relationships, and the spiritual consequences of rebellion.
When these kids leave, it's to the nth degree that we Mormons can't fathom. I mean, yes, my parents were upset with me. Jenny's parents were upset with her, but we still talk. These boys can't. They're completely, utterly cut off, and more so, they don't exist.
And they discuss the overarching themes of the story.
In our religions, we say family is a value. Then when you lose that religion or somebody moves away from it, then we have to find a better way to negotiate, making those family values mean that you aren't cut off from your family. You can maintain those bonds in some way.
Sons of Perdition. A candid discussion with the filmmakers. Next, on Mormon Stories.
Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I am your host, as always, John DeLynn. And today I'm very excited to have with us two very special guests, Jenny Lynn Merton and Tyler Meesom. Hi, guys.
Hey, John.
Hi, how's it going?
So Jenny Lynn and Tyler are in Logan promoting, I'm going to call it a new movie, Sons of Perdition. Some of you may have heard of it. Some of you may have seen it. It's a movie about the Lost Boys of the FLDS Church, or the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they did a special screening here in Logan last night, and it was fantastic. I loved it. And documentaries are really hard to do well, and they did it well, and they captured some really important messages. So I wanted to bring them on and talk about the film. And in typical Mormon Stories fashion, I think before we do that, maybe we'll capture a little bit of each of their stories just to kind of get a sense for what would lead two bright young people to make a movie on this topic. So let's start with Jenny Lynn. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what would lead you to make a movie about the Lost Boys.
Well, a little portion of craziness, I think. Absolutely. I'll just say we were on the project for 5+ years.
Wow.
So it took a little crazy. But I grew up in the LDS church in Oregon on the West Coast, and in a small liberal college town, and then moved out to BYU and did a year and a half there. And that was the point that I decided the church sort of wasn't for me. And it was a very traumatic experience, not only going from West Coast Mormonism to Utah Mormonism, but leaving the church and negotiating, leaving with my family. I ended up getting married and divorced and moved 6 times and left the church and left my school and within a year.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite an experience. And
were you raised in a pretty devout home?
I was. My parents are both converts, but yeah, very religious home. And, you know, the years went by. I ended up at the University of Utah, finished my bachelor's there, and then went back for a PhD and met Tyler, and we really bonded over our stories of having left the church but still trying to maintain a spiritual life. And along the way, we heard this story about the Lost Boys and the kids leaving the church, and we just thought, this is our story writ large. And we had birthed so many people through their own process of leaving that it was a story really close to our hearts and something that we felt like needed to be talked about, you know, religious exile in our own country. And so I was feeling like I wanted to get out of the academic ivory tower and get into the field. And we just kind of took a leap of faith, if you will, and went out and found the kids and started filming. I mean, it was really one of those things that you just jump off a cliff and know you have to do. So
I should just say the movie's about much more than fundamentalist Mormonism. And even if you were to want to peg it as a movie about leaving religion or faith, I think that would be selling it short. It's for me, I saw many different areas where people could relate to it, whether they're struggling in their faith, whether they're making some important type of life transition that takes a lot of courage. A lot of my gay and lesbian friends that I have are going to relate in their experiences about coming out. Tyler, why don't you just talk a little bit about the high level theme, just so people understand that it can connect with people on lots of different levels.
Well, you know, we follow these boys for 2.5 years. And these are three boys who are kicked out of Colorado City. They have very little education, very little knowledge of the outside world, and they're told they're going to hell. And then they're thrust out into this world they know nothing or very, very little about. And at first, it's very titillating. It's just very much, you know, girls and parties and beer and pop music and rap music and MTV. And they just inundate. They throw themselves in to a point where it's dangerous to where they really suffer. And then they realize this hurts. You know, this isn't something I want to do. I can't continue living this as a 16-year-old boy without parental guidance for too long. Now, I left the Mormon faith as well. I was raised in a very devout Mormon family here in Utah, went on a mission. And then at one point, I just realized and recognized that it wasn't for me. And I went through a very long, difficult, trying process of thinking and prayer and study and talking. And I didn't have anyone to turn to. I didn't have anyone to talk to. I didn't have anyone really to understand because everyone I knew was Mormon.
Were you raised in a pretty devout home as well?
Yes, very much. 5 sisters, 1 brother. And, you know, and my parents were abject against it. They just did not like that I was leaving the church. And I was their golden boy who went on a mission. And I tried to hide it from them. It was very, very difficult for me. I say this often, and I say it to people who are in the church, and I say, you know, I dare say I've done more prayer, fasting, thought, and discussion about my faith where I am right now, which is essentially none, than you have about yours, because I really went through an exhausting deconversion period that wasn't easy. So in the film, in a way, I went through the same process they did. I came home from my mission. I drank. I drugged. It was girls. It was this beautiful new world. And I moved to Dallas where it was gay people and fun and interesting and sex and religion and new stuff. And I almost overdosed in all of this overwhelming. And I've said this before. When I hear people who are LDS and they say, if I ever leave the church, you know, I couldn't leave it because all I'd want to do was drink and have sex. And I go, well, you would, but eventually you'd get tired of it. And I've used the analogy that if you leave a diet, you might eat Twinkies and ice cream for a day or two, but you're not going to do that the rest of your time. Eventually, you're going to find a sensible middle ground. Mm. And so I went through a bit what the boys went through. And we see that in the film. We see them really overdose in a way. And they go so far to one side, and then they realize that they need to find a nice middle ground. It's interesting what you said about gay people, because we have a lot of gay people who really enjoy the film and really recognize the pain that these kids go through when they leave their community.
Right.
And when they leave, when these kids leave, it's to the nth degree that we Mormons can't fathom. I mean, yes, my parents were upset with me. Jenny's parents were upset with her, but we still talk. We still can go and visit. These boys can't. They're completely, utterly cut off. And more so, they don't exist. Their names are taken off the record. They're ground into the native element, and they go to neither hell nor heaven nor any of the celestial, telestial, terrestrial kingdoms. They essentially walk through outer darkness. And that's a pretty heavy weight for a 16-year-old to carry.
You know, we have a sizable believing audience, and I just want to make sure that the listeners know that I didn't at all feel an anti-religious sentiment. I think that a believer, you know, there is some language, and people should know that in the official cinematic version, there is some language, and it did receive an R rating. At the same time, we'll talk about the DVD, which has a clean version. But I want to make sure believers know that this is not like a Michael Moore, take pot shots, Bill Maher, eviscerate belief and mock people. At least that's not the sense that I felt. I got the sense that this was a movie bending over backwards to be respectful and just to let people tell their own stories, and then people can kind of connect the dots for themselves. But for the most part, I don't think devout Mormons are going to feel assaulted by this movie. In fact, it may reinforce some of their own approaches, because certainly the traditional LDS church is a lot less extreme than the FLDS.
Absolutely. And I mean, our families are still Mormon and they have seen the movie. My entire family came out to New York for our premiere and we're very happy with it. And we've had a couple comments here and there, but ultimately, Tyler and I really wanted to make a film about the boys' individual stories and let them tell those stories. But even as these kids are leaving the FLDS, they are struggling to figure out who they are and to find their own faith and to find their own spiritual practice. And the kids have told us and have said in certain parts in the movie, you know, I still believe in God. I still believe, and I'm still searching to believe and figure out, you know, where I fit in the world. And so it is certainly not an anti-religion film in any way. It is a spiritual journey.
Right.
And it continues to be for these kids. And we promised the kids as we were making the film that we would show some of the negatives of their particular experience and some of the crimes that Warren Jeffs, you know, is committing, but that we would not say certain things about their parents or try to bring religion down, or, you know, we wanted the story to speak for itself.
I even noticed you tried to blur out the faces of anyone who kind of wasn't central to the story. You worked really hard, even in your camera shots and angles. If it wasn't someone who is out, you tried to not show their identity in any way that might compromise them. So I saw a lot of care there. Is that...
Absolutely. I mean, we blurred out, in terms of some of the photographs, we legally had to blur out pictures of kids. It's very dangerous for these kids to leave, and it was dangerous for them to even share their stories with us. And some of the people that shared quite a bit really put themselves on the line to get this story out. And we felt very beholden to them and wanted to be as respectful as possible, because they share their stories, and then that can get their family in trouble, can further alienate them from any chance of having a connection. And so, I mean, these were really brave kids, and you can't, you know, nobody wants to make a documentary at the expense of somebody else's safety.
Totally. Well, let's back up and let's give our listeners a bit of the history. So I want to refer my listeners to a podcast we did with Anne Wild several years ago. She is a polygamist. She's a spokeswoman for modern polygamy. She's not a member of the FLDS Church. We did a whole 5-segment YouTube video of her talking about how she went from a traditional LDS believer to a polygamist, what it was like and what she believes. It was really fascinating. You know, so we've covered polygamy a bit, and we have also interviewed Todd Compton. I'm sure you've read his book. But let's just briefly go over a little bit of the history of Short Creek or Colorado City. Where does the FLDS Church start?
The FLDS Church comes into being as essentially, you know, Mormons abdicate polygamy in the 1890s. And for a while it went underground and the church was essentially still tacitly supporting it. And it wasn't really until the 1920s, 1930s where the mainstream Mormon church began excommunicating its members for still practicing polygamy. And the FLDS essentially began to create a separate identity from the Mormon church as we get into the early 20th century. And, you know, Short Creek existed as a small farming community. And as their church grew, as FLDS grew, they began to work south. But they had two communities, essentially one up in the Salt Lake area and one down in Short Creek. And they became more and more sort of hostile to the Mormon church. And, you know, at one point, Warren calls the mainstream Mormon church the great and abominable church. Or,
wow.
You know,
I don't think the church has ever had that.
Yeah.
That scripture quoted back on them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And because they believe, I mean, and the reason they call themselves the fundamentalist LDS is, you know, they really believe that they are the true Mormons and that they are the ones that have stuck by the principle and are still following plural marriage. And so as they grew, they, you know, became more and more in conflict with the mainstream church. And so the FLDS is essentially the first break off from the LDS church. From the FLDS church along the way, there were break off after break off, and all of these different strains of other polygamous groups began to kind of move out. I mean, there was the LeBarons and the All Reds and different groups in Mexico and Canada, but they all essentially start from the FLDS.
You mean the first polygamous break off?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Just making
yes.
sure. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so now you have a number of different groups, although the FLDS remains the largest and the most influential.
And of course, there's some lore that maybe even John Taylor or Wilford Woodruff sort of gave them the commission to keep the principle alive. And there's, I think, a handwritten letter that
exactly.
some people question the authenticity of, but But right. One thing that's certain is that the LDS Church continued to practice and believe in polygamy long after the 1890 Manifesto. So it wouldn't be totally unreasonable to think that there was at least some strains that wanted the principle to be kept alive because we had sacrificed so much. I mean, Joseph died over polygamy. We moved west over polygamy. Prophets had said it was a requirement for exaltation. And so it makes sense that these people really felt like they were told to keep it alive, even if the church itself had to walk away from it.
Absolutely. You know, and their sort of history of prophets goes from Joseph Smith and sometimes includes John Taylor and then jumps into the FLDS prophets and, you know, completely skips the other Mormon prophets. And when you get contemporary Mormons who leave the Mormon church to join polygamy, it is based on that sort of feeling that they're going back to a fundamental sense of the church, going back to these fundamental principles that the church sacrificed for.
So, they should have some marketing guys put a t-shirt that says real Mormons or true Mormons or something like that, you know.
Those true Mormons do it twice or have two.
Something.
I do Mormonism.
So what's it like growing up in Short Creek? Let's talk about the beauty or the good of it or what the compelling nature of it. You know, I mean, a lot of these boys, probably the most powerful scene in the movie for me, and I bet you guys hear this a lot, is when these boys were singing those primary songs or those church songs. And you just see these kids that are just out on their own and sometimes doing drugs and living this hard life. And all of a sudden, they just start singing these primary songs and, you know, tears well up. You can tell that they really loved their childhood. So talk a little bit about what that childhood would be like.
Well, one day we were driving through Colorado City with the boys, and there's actually a scene in the film where we're driving with Sam and Joe, and they're pointing out places they were raised and things they did. And I mean, first off, Colorado City, Hilldale area is stunningly beautiful. It's right under the gorgeous mountain range of Red Rocks, and it's just phenomenally beautiful. And it's hidden, and they knew that what they were doing when they were there. They're right on the border of Arizona, Utah, and it's out in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's miles from anywhere else.
And the border thing is so they could run across whichever policeman came, they could run to the other side kind of thing?
There's a lot of laws that work in Utah that don't work in Arizona, and they'll say, well, she was married in Arizona. No, she was married in Utah.
Right.
And so they really...
makes it ambiguous.
It makes it very, very difficult. And they're dealing with two entities and two states and two governments and two different police forces. But nonetheless, we were driving through this town, and they were showing us these beautiful parts, and they said, oh, over there was where the community would get together, and they'd have these big parties and these big events. And, you know, over there we'd have these Saturday work projects where we'd help somebody. And we build a barn, and the wives would make a big, huge lunch for everybody, and we'd all get together. And it just had this very Mayberry-esque feel to it, with this community that helped each other and cared for each other and donated food to one another and just really kept to themselves. And yes, they practiced polygamy, and yes, they would go after the government for money, but it was this very beautiful community of people that cared for each other. And these boys, while they were raised without music and TV and radio, they were raised without...
And education.
And education, but they were raised without violence and raised without... fear of walking in the streets at night and fear of any other thing that a lot of kids in the city don't have. But then
there's a part in the movie where somebody asks one of the boys about a comic book, and he's like, what's a comic book? Right?
Yeah, they really don't know anything about the outside world.
Yeah.
Be it, they didn't know that man landed on the moon. They don't know TV. They don't know popular culture. They don't know anything of that nature. And, you know, we were fortunate to introduce them to a lot of it. So they really were raised in this idyllic situation until Warren Jeffs came in. And Warren Jeffs, who was his father's right-hand man, his father, Rulon Jeffs, who was the prophet at the time, and his father was weaning in his health, and Warren kind of, in a very Machiavellian, Shakespearean way, usurped the power from his father and became the mouthpiece for his father and really started to crack down. And then he pulled the kids out.
So before then, Rulon was more reasonable?
I would say Rulon was less reasonable than the prophet before him, Leroy Johnson.
So they just got more and more strict and harsh. And
it wasn't overnight. Warren's an evil, evil man and a narcissist and a pedophile and you name it. But he knew how to, there's a certain level of respect, how he subjugated this community and slowly cramped down on them and used fear of the outside, fear of everyone else against themselves and claimed we are the righteous. And, you know, it's been used from day one, any kind of entity, Hitler, and he was a student of Hitler, you know, make them fear everyone else, tell them they are the best. And you see that in a lot of governments. They'll do the same thing.
Yeah.
And he used them against themselves in a way to create this power that he had. So yes, for a long time it was a very, I don't want to say wonderful, but it was a very good situation for the boys to be raised in. And then at one point it just became so difficult, especially with Warren in power, that they had to leave.
What was it like for these boys in their home with their moms and their dad and siblings?
You know, I think it was a mixed experience for them because, I mean, like Tyler was saying, there was this sort of bucolic benefits of a rural community. I mean, it was, they had big, strong families. They did all of their activities with their families. I mean, they had harvest festivals. They were very close to their families and very close to their siblings. And you get raised with 30 kids. So, you know, you could have two moms, you might have 20 moms. And so you have a kind of society within a society. So you grow up, you get up, you pray in the morning, you work. Before they were pulled out of public school, a lot of the kids would say, well, I don't really want to go to school, I'll go and work. And so,
and the main source of work
was construction.
Okay.
You know, anything from, you know, welding, framing. I mean, the community would put up a house from plot of land to finished with paint and carpet in 24 hours.
Whoa.
We have video. We have some really badly shot video that we got confiscated from somebody, but they could turn that around. And so,
they're good craftsmen.
They are very good craftsmen, and the kids take pride in their work, even though they were pulled out of school to be working at 6, 7, 8 years
old. This
is
large scale commercial real estate stuff.
Right. We're talking
all over the U.S.
Yeah. The polygamists would get government contracts, federal contracts, local contracts, and a lot of the times would be able to underbid local businesses because they were using child labor and had very skilled children that they just didn't have to pay.
Right.
And so, the kids grew up with really strong families, but they also grew up with a lot of abuse. I mean, there was widespread physical abuse. There was sexual abuse. And it's not to say that that doesn't happen in other communities, but there were no outlets for them to go to. There was no one to go talk to if something happened.
Right.
And there was a lot of pressure on the fathers and the men in the community to keep their kids in line. And so it was much better to beat your kid than to risk having your family taken away. Because if you can't keep your family in line, Warren would take your wives and kids and give them to somebody else. Drop of a hat.
One of my favorite parts of the movie is this guy you've got doing drywall and sheetrock in a garage, and he's standing on this bucket of paste, and you see him scooting the bucket along as he's sheetrocking the wall, as he's sort of telling his experience. What a great character that guy was.
That's Kevin, and he was one of the first Lost Boys to leave, and he left partially because of the violence, the physical violence between his mother and father, and being constantly beaten or being in between fights, and he lived out of his truck and ate out of trash cans before there was this network, underground network of Lost Boys helping each other, but he really risked a lot to speak with us.
So, he did?
Because he kind of straddled the side between the polygamists and the St. George Mormon community doing construction work. And so when his polygamist clients would find out that he was speaking to the press or supporting the Lost Boys, then they would sometimes pull contracts or give him a hard time. But he really worked hard to help take care of the kids that were coming out.
He's probably one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, we love him.
So the perception is, I don't even know if there's one perception, but what I was thinking was that, like, at some point Warren just kicks these kids out. Like, they have to just round up a certain percentage to make the math work, to make the numbers work. You know, they need more women than men. Is it that sort of calculated, or is it a little bit more sophisticated or nuanced?
You know, that is kind of the prevailing thought, is that they kick the boys out purely because there's competition for more wives. And while that is one of the underlying factors, there are a lot of reasons why these boys are kicked out or forced out or they leave. And we've heard stories as extreme as boys being driven to the side of the road, given $20, and said, you're on your own.
Wow.
A boy named Holden Barlow, he's very active in helping ex-polygamists leave and get on their feet. He was driven to a house, a foster home, and their mother dropped him off and said, call us when he kills himself. And they turned and walked away. These stories rip your heart out. Mm. Now, the boys in our film, they weren't kicked out, but there's such a fine line between being kicked out and being forced out. They knew they had no future in the community. They knew that they weren't going to a scale where they wanted to be. They knew that there was a good chance they would never date or have a wife. And so they left on their own accord.
Did you sense that any left because of cognitive dissonance, that it felt wrong or felt abusive or didn't add up?
I think internally they knew that there was something wrong. They didn't know what it was. And I also think there's this titillation factor of what's out there. what is this world? Joe, in the film, he snuck out one day and went and saw Madagascar and got in deep trouble for it. Probably the only person in the world getting in trouble for watching Madagascar. But you know, it kind of planted the seed that there's a world out there we're interested in. And we've all snuck out of the house.
What movie theater would he have gone to? Do you know?
I think he was working on a job site in Vegas.
Oh, okay.
The reason he got in trouble, too, was not just that he saw Madagascar, but he saw it with his apostate brother who had already left.
Oh.
And he came back to the work site and his boss realized that he'd been out with another son of perdition, with an apostate, and that got him in trouble. And just to add to what Tyler was saying, there is definitely this cognitive dissonance for some of the boys. I mean, there is a story that they told us, essentially when Warren came into power, he got up in one of their major church meetings and had a number of the church's most popular and beloved elders stand up in the church meeting and said, "You have not been righteous. I am not pleased with you. And you need to get up and walk out and leave the community and repent from a distance." And these were the pillars of the community with, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10 wives, and their families are sitting right there. And the men got up and walked out and left. And those families were given to other men and moved into different houses. And the kids began to see the breakdown of their community. And, you know, and Bruce came home one day and that happened to him. His family, he had 3 mothers. They were just gone. His entire family was gone. And no explanation, just his father had angered Warren. And so these kids began to realize that the ground was shifting underneath them in an untenable way. And
so fathers can be excommunicated and kicked out of the community, and then their wives can be reassigned to other men, and even children can be reassigned. I mean,
the FLDS Church is more of a business than any kind of religion. It is all about winning favor with the CEO, Warren Jeffs, the prophet. Those who keep secrets, those who will make money, those who give enough money to Warren Jeffs remain in his favor. And if you are on his good side, you receive young wives and young brides and homes. And not only will you be given a bride, you will be given the person's home. Warren, numerous times, will just kick a man out and move another man into his home and take over those wives and those children.
And the church owns all the property, right?
Yeah, and the children would actually take the name of that father. And Warren, wisely enough, the church was under the UEP, the United Effort Plan was what it was called, and all the land was owned by the church. And for a while, it was actually this very communal socialist society where they helped each other and cared for each other. Now, on his deathbed, Warren had his father sign the UEP rights over to him. Mm. So Warren owned all their property, all their land, all their homes, right, and essentially them. He taught these people that the children didn't belong to them. The children were the property of the church. The wives were the property of the church. So everything, human beings, plants, animals, land, was the property of the church, essentially the property of Warren Jeffs.
One of the most powerful parts of the movie was the audio of Warren Jeffs' voice, where he would be talking about his doctrine, his teachings. He used a very interesting voice, and his teachings are crazy. Where did that audio come from?
We ended up with about 110 sermons, and oddly enough, we got those off of somebody's iPod.
Really?
And one of the
podcast.
Exactly. Warren Jeffs does have a podcast, right, and he would give these sermons, and they would be recorded, and you can hear him at the beginning, you know, of some of the sermons, you know, giving the date and, you know, and welcoming everybody and testing the audio on the microphone, and and then they would be recorded, and that was the only music, or he would be singing, and that was the only dogma, doctrine, music, sound that they were allowed to listen to. You know, so the people think that they're Amish. They weren't without technology. They had computers, they had iPods, they had cell phones, but they were used specifically for these purposes. And so we ended up with over 100 sermons, and it was some...
Can you release those at some point? Is that problematic?
I mean, we could. We have, you know, given them to other sources to use in news. We gave some of them to the Texas Rangers to help use in his trial.
Yeah, you guys helped him maybe get convicted.
Yeah, we did. I'll let Tyler explain that. We had the Texas Rangers and a bunch of polygamists all in Tyler's house one night doing interviews, and one of the women who saw Sons of Perdition actually after seeing the film decided to testify.
When you make a documentary, and there's a lot of people that make documentaries, you hope that it will make a difference. You hope that people will be affected by it. And you hope you put a dent in the societal ill that you are shining a light on. And we are very happy that our film has been used in Texas and in Canada in the anti-polygamy law. But the Texas Rangers and the Texas Attorney Generals watched the film, and they would literally come up to my house and we'd meet, and I'd introduce them to people and introduce them to witnesses. And they were these guys would come in white hats and boots and guns and badges and yes sir, yes ma'ams. And they were very good at what they did. And we introduced them to the witnesses that eventually testified against Warren Jeffs. And it was fantastic. It was interesting to compare how little our state of Utah and how little our attorney general and law enforcement did in the trial against Warren Jeffs versus what the Texas attorney generals did. The Texas attorney generals were completely prepared. They did all their research. They did everything they could. They contacted us. They talked with us. They had all their angles. And I remember the Texas attorney general talking to me and he said, the lawyers who Warren has secured are amazing. They're amazing lawyers. And we have to have everything in our pocket, ready against him. And they researched, they did more than you would even believe, to the point where I call out our Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, for doing very little against the fight against Warren Jeffs. What's interesting is the Texas Attorney Generals were so prepared in their fight against Warren Jeffs' lawyers, but on the day of his trial, he fired his lawyers.
Yeah, I saw that.
So basically,
what's your theory on why Shurtleff wouldn't go hard? I mean, the church has certainly distanced itself from polygamy and wants these people to be brought to justice. What's your theory on why Utah wouldn't go after these people hard?
Well, I will say that it's a very complicated and difficult issue. A lot of people think it's the extermination of let's go in and get rid of all of them, completely, utterly break it up. And we've seen that doesn't work. You can't fire.
Yeah, they tried that, right? In the 40s or 50s.
The Short Creek Raid. They went in and pulled the parents away from the children and the wives away, and it became a public relations disaster. And you saw the same thing happen in Texas. It became a disaster.
But the mess Texas would have had to clean up probably would have been a lot smaller than the mess Utah would have to clean up. Is that right?
Well, yeah. And while Texas, I think, probably failed in their approach of that, it garnered them literally semi-truck loads full of evidence that eventually put Warren Jeffs away and a lot of other individuals. So I can't exactly say why Utah has been negligent in their enforcing of these laws. It helps, as we stated earlier, that the Utah-Arizona border, Arizona hasn't done much about it either. And I don't think people say, well, why don't you just stop it? It's illegal. Why can't we just arrest the polygamists? Well, A, they're way ahead of us on that. They don't marry more than one wife. They right. marry one wife. They spirit marry the other one, two, three, X amount. So they're very good at finding out and figuring out how to averse these laws. So while I think Utah has definitely failed in it, and I have my own theories of which I'll keep to myself for the most part, I will say that I've heard rumors and ills about Mark Shurtleff getting a job with the law firm that represents Warren Jeffs after his tenure is done, which I frankly believe. I do think it's very difficult. And what Jenny and I have tried to do with our foundation that we've teamed up with is these kids have no education. They have very little education, very little knowledge of the outside world. And not too long ago, I was down in Colorado City, and there were kids out playing, and they were running around, and they were in the park, and it was beautiful. It was wonderful. Because for so long, kids couldn't leave the house. Nobody could leave the house. And I thought, this is really great. Warren must be loosening up. And then I realized, my God, this is a Tuesday at 11 o'clock. These kids should be in school. Why aren't these kids in school?
Right.
And I think one of the main issues is right now that they're being homeschooled. And in the state of Utah, it's enough to just say you're being homeschooled. There has to be some criteria. There has to be some kind of testing. Because if they're not testing them now, what happens is they leave and they become a burden on society later.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another stark thing about the movie, was just the low education levels of these boys. It seems like they couldn't use proper English. They had a hard time just writing basic sentences. Their knowledge of history and of culture and civics just seemed very low. They just seemed very uneducated, not necessarily dumb, but just poorly educated.
Yeah, I mean, the kids are actually really intelligent, very highly skilled kids. They just have not been exposed. Sam Brower says it very well. He says it's like being dropped in a foreign country. And for them, that's exactly what it was. I mean, they basically got religion and math.
So they could do the books.
Well, so that they could do construction. You know, they had just enough math to cut boards and do construction
right.
and that
Geometry.
Type of thing. But they were, by the end, you know, the sort of height of Warren's tenure, I mean, he had shut down their library. And then just even recently, they actually burned all of what books were left in the town. You know, just last year, actually had an old-fashioned witch-burning, you know, book fire in the middle of Colorado City.
He prohibited education at some point. So
right. Part of it was to separate them from the other polygamous groups that were still doing public schooling. And it was to prepare for the end. It was to prepare for the year 2000, for the second coming. And right. Yeah, he wanted to insulate them even further from the outside world. And it's ironic because Warren Jeffs, before he became prophet, was actually a principal. He was a teacher.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because they come out with a lack of education, but what they are is very mature in their own way. When you're 6 years old and you're on a job site, when you can run a Bobcat, you grow up quickly. When you're a 13-year-old girl and you're married and having babies, you become an adult very, very quickly. And add to that the fact that they couldn't play games, they couldn't ride bikes, they couldn't play with dollies. You know, they didn't have a normal childhood. So when they come out, they're 40 going on 10.
Yeah. There's a scene in the movie where this little kid's driving a four-wheeler, pulling like four other little kids behind him. And the kid looks like he's like five, and he's operating a four-wheeler. And then there's another one where they're on the job site, and you see these little 12-year-old, I don't know how old they were, just these young kids wielding their hammers and their machinery and framing this house.
Oh, yeah.
It's like these are men in little boys' bodies.
Yeah, they definitely are raised to be adults, and they're talked to as adults, and they're treated as adults.
Tell the story about the air conditioning or the furnace going out in Texas during the...
These kids are very adept at every form of construction, be it fine carpentry to framing to heavy machinery. And at a young age, they're taught this, and almost more so than most kids get an education in the outside world. They are taught down to the finest level on how to build a house. During the Texas raid, they took all these kids and women and they put them in one big gymnasium, and the air conditioning broke, and it was a hot Texas August day.
Right.
And so they brought out these professionals to try and fix the air conditioning, and they couldn't figure it out. And apparently one of the 7-year-old boys walked up, pointed to the air conditioning and said, "Oh, this is your problem. You have this issue and this issue and this issue." And literally, you know, knew more about the air conditioning unit than these four professionals that they'd brought in. So we see that, and we see the boys work, and we see them during the film. Joe rattles off this laundry list of the things that he can do. And he's 17 years old, and he's more knowledgeable about equipment than most professionals are.
So let's dive a little bit into the boys now. We've talked a lot about the framework, the kind of the context and the history. And we've talked some about the boys, but let's give them their fair focus for a minute. Lost. In what ways are these boys lost? And tell some stories of how shocking and earth-shattering and confusing it is for them to step into the real world, which you could even say St. George isn't necessarily.
A nice transition stage to St. George. You know, they use that term lost boys. You know, a lot of people just assume it, they're lost. They don't know where they're going. But essentially, it comes from Peter Pan. If you remember, the lost boys are the kids that live on that island where there's no parents. So that's essentially where it comes from. The boys obviously don't really recognize that analogy. But when they come out, they know very, very little. And for Jenny and I to kind of be their tour guide to this world was very exciting in a lot of ways. I remember one day we drove from St. George to Salt Lake. And, you know, when they came out, they fell into Eminem, the music Eminem. Right. And I don't know why, which is complete antithesis of what they had before.
And they're bleaching their hair.
Yeah, they go crazy with their hair. And that, you know, their hair is a running theme throughout the film. And we can talk about that a bit. But they didn't know music at all. And one day when we drove, and I'm a big music aficionado, so one day when we drove to St. George to Salt Lake, this 4-hour drive, I gave them the history of rock and roll from Delta Blues to the Beatles to the Stones, you know, all the way up to punk to grunge to modern music. And I gave them the history of music. And, you know, I said, you don't need to like Stairway to Heaven, but you have to know, you know, to exist in this world. But I think one thing that was very interesting is that, you know, that I think it was that next day, and it's profiled in the film. We took them up to Salt Lake, and we took them into churches, and, you know, they talk about churches they'd never seen, and we showed them buildings, and it was beautiful to watch their eyes just being opened. But they were taught that black men are evil. They are the spawn of Cain. They're just completely evil. And I have a friend, a black gentleman, and I introduced him to him. And he came up and he shook their hand. "Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. You guys look great. Welcome to Salt Lake. It's good to see you." And they were so friendly and so happy. And I literally could see their minds being blown, because everything they'd been taught, that the black man will kill you, black man will rape you, he will take your money. And here comes this funny, jovial black man. And the boys just, it just shook everything they'd been taught. And it was just interesting to see that turnabout in a 5-second interval.
Well, and it was great, because afterwards they were like, "Oh my God, that was the first black person I've ever shook hands with." I mean, they were so excited. And then to see them along the way as we finished the film and went on some film festivals with the kids, they just became so much more adept at interacting with a variety of people of all sort of colors and types and backgrounds, and crammed 10 years of learning into a couple of years. And probably one of the more remarkable moments for us was with this young woman who we weren't able to put into the film. She wouldn't agree to sign a release form, but she was one of Warren Jeff's wives, and she had been fostered in the same home, Jeremy Johnson and his wife, Sharla. And she was working on her GED book, and Sharla was trying to help her, and she could not figure out the geography. And the reason she was having so much trouble is that she thought that the United States was the entire world. Mm. So she was looking at the 50 states. She couldn't reconcile that with this new knowledge about countries and all these other sort of continents and names, because, you know, she was seeing all these sort of shapes in the book and they didn't fit the 50 states that she knew. And so finally she kept saying, this is the whole world. This is the whole world. And Sharla said, no, it's not. You know, America is not the whole world as much as some of us would like to think. And so she pulled out a globe, and this young woman, you know, 21-year-old woman, had never seen a globe before. She didn't know what the North and South poles were. And it was this stunning moment where this beautiful young girl who was just staring at this globe, and Sharla took her around the globe and talked about the continents, and was one of those ones that lit up, and she plugged it in and it was getting dark, and just have this amazing moment of this girl with her face lit up looking at the world for the first time, and, you know, awestruck and having to feel badly. You know, she just said, your four-year-old knows more about this than I do. And Sharla just said, you know what, it just takes time. You're learning an entirely new set of things. And it was a really sort of beautiful, sad moment all at the same time.
And Charlotte's Jeremy's wife?
Charlotte's Jeremy's wife.
Jeremy, what a fascinating character. It's this kind of uber wealthy, young, charismatic entrepreneur who presents himself in the film as just this guy who's going to dedicate a portion of his life to saving these lost boys. And you see him trying to help these people come out. He gives home and shelter to these boys for how long?
Well, some of the boys, Bruce stayed a little bit longer, but it was between 9 months and a year. And then he helped set up a transition home for some of the boys as well for a while. And he was part of a group of Mormon families in the St. George area that were fostering some of the kids that were coming out of Colorado City. And when he had grown up as a kid in his own Mormon family, his family had fostered people from some of the other polygamous groups. And people ask, well, why would this guy take kids in? And when we were editing the film in New York, a lot of the people that watched drafts of the film would just say, you know, this guy's creepy, or why would somebody do that? And it was a little bit difficult for us to explain this Mormon tradition of taking people into your home and helping them. I mean, both Tyler and I, our families, we always had somebody that we were taking care of. You know, our families would take people in, and it's such a good Mormon tradition.
It is.
It was hard for people to sort of figure.
Wrap their brain around it. There's this scene where Jeremy is like confronting the parents of some of these lost boys, where he's like walking up to the pickup truck and speaking to them inside the vehicle. There are a couple moments like that in the film, and for some reason that was really scary to me. Just the notion of these people driving up in their big pickup trucks and being willing to stand up right there at their face and talk to them face to face. It felt like that would be terrifying, but that's just how I experienced it.
Well, there's a number of incidents in the film where polygamists come and try to reclaim their wives or their daughter who has escaped. And I wish you could see all the things that happened around that scene. Right. Helicopter chases and, you know, money and drop-offs and just days worth of back and forth and back and forth. And Jenny Lynn and I were, we became embroiled in a number of events and situations, and we helped a lot of people leave the community by our own accord. And the film starts with a 14-year-old girl jumping in our car and saying, go, 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 get me out of here.
Wow.
So, you know, we became a major part of it, and we harbored some people who needed help, and we did it willingly. We wouldn't go back and take anything back, but we faced the ire of the community. I was arrested in Colorado City by polygamous policemen who locked me up and took me away and put me in their squad car for misleading an officer. And even now, we face a little bit of wrath, and I think some of the kids who are in the film do as well. Bruce's grandfather died, and he went down to go to the funeral, and they wouldn't let him in because of his involvement in the film.
Yeah, there's a point in the film where a boy calls home and says, hey, can I just see one of my brothers or sisters? And you could see that the parents said no on the other end. And yeah. He's like, okay, well, all right, I understand.
He just wants his mom's cooking, you know, because they come out and they can't cook. They eat fast food and he misses his mom's pie.
Yeah.
there were definitely some scary moments in making this film for us, some confrontations, and we never set out to go rescue people. You know, the same way when we helped other people deal with the emotional setbacks of leaving the Mormon church, you know, we never went out there to pull people out or to deliberately make people make decisions, but we found ourselves usually completely surprised. You know, we went down to film one escape, and all of a sudden at midnight, Joe turns to me and says, "Well, you can take her, right? You guys will hide her." You know, it's midnight, you know, and all of a sudden we found ourselves, you know, crossing state lines with a runaway.
Wow.
So there were some scary, definitely scary moments, but I think you just know when you have to do the right thing and when you've exhausted all your legal possibilities, sometimes you take some risks you never thought you would.
I think probably the most moving part of the whole film is just to see these boys wishing that their moms and siblings could get out and join them. And it's not like they just go about their merry life. I mean, what seems like they just work to get by, and then they spend as much time as they can thinking about, longing for their moms, sometimes their dads, and then helping, sometimes through multiple efforts, trying to get them out. Talk about that for a bit, just that process of trying and trying again to set the family free.
Well, I'll let Tyler talk about the escapes, but I will say that so much of the movie for us is really about family, and it is about how much family matters, and it was incredibly important to these kids, and that was the hardest thing for them, was to lose their families and to be cut off from them. And Sam says in the movie, you know, family should be your religion, and that ultimately is the sort of message that in our religions we say family is a value. Then when you lose that religion or somebody moves away from it, then we have to find a better way to negotiate making those family values mean that you aren't cut off from your family. You can maintain those bonds in some way. But it took us a lot of work to get some of the kids out.
There were a lot of times as well, we would meet with the parents of these boys and girls. We actually followed a couple of girls. We followed one girl who only has a small scene in the film, but we'd have dinner with their parents. They'd eat with us and talk to us. But it was very interesting how they were so standoffish towards their child. We'd meet at a restaurant, me and Sam and his parents. We all met at this restaurant in Hurricane, and it was very informal. They didn't hug their son. They didn't say, "How are you doing?" They didn't want to catch up.
Now, is that because they don't have a culture of affection or because they had left?
They left. They're no longer their children of sorts. And they don't want to give them any welcome. They don't want to make them feel like they've done anything right. They're not their child anymore. And Jenny told an incident of when you had dinner with Jennifer's father.
Yeah, Jennifer, though, she's the girl in the movie who shows us how to do your hair as a polygamist.
Right. Puff, that was a great scene.
Yeah, puff, poof, and wave. We have a handout if you want to know how. But no, I met with her father and her first mother at a very nice restaurant in St. George, and it was a sort of surreal experience because, you know, her father looked like a normal middle-aged man, but her birth mother was in her full polygamist wear and didn't say a word throughout the dinner. But we had a bottle of wine. We had this very nice discussion. Her father was much more worldly because his construction work had taken him all over the country. But it was really...
Did they drink?
Yes, they did. And
they drank wine?
Yes, he did, yeah. They drink coffee, they do drink wine. But it was a really strange experience because here Jennifer is sitting with me and it was essentially as though they had had to give her up. And the father kept speaking to me as though I was now in charge of his daughter and would refer to me, you know, "Thank you for helping her out," and was talking about her as though she weren't there. You know, not in a vicious way, but in a sort of resigned way of, "I've had to give up my connection to this person and thanking you for essentially becoming her surrogate." And it was as though this transaction of bodies had happened. And I had a friend with me for the dinner who had nothing to do with the film, who just happened to be down in St. George. And he said, "You know, what's the big deal? They seem like such nice people. You know, why are you investigating them?" And I just said, "You know, yeah, they seem like normal, nice people. But tomorrow, if she were still in the community, she would be married. You know, he would marry this girl to a 50-year-old man in a heartbeat and give her an hour to prep." Her sister had less than 24 hours to prep for her marriage at 16 to a complete stranger in the community.
And it can go as low as 14, right?
13. Warren did marry a 12-year-old, and then she was pregnant by 13, yeah. Which was one of the pieces of evidence that they were able to use against him in the trial. He actually swapped his second-in-command, basically gave Warren his daughter for one of Warren's young daughters. Yeah, as Jennifer in the movie says, it's like being sold on eBay.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, the women are treated as chattel. They really are. They're bartered and swapped and bought and sold, but only by Warren, right, through his edicts.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers.
Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Journey's through.